are so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January the 25th, 2019. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by my co-host, Carol Davies-McIntosh.
Hello, everyone.
Veganuary is still upon us, and it's a great time of the year to consider your food choices and make the switch to veganism for your health and the health and wellness of all those who inhabit the earth. As you may have heard in the mainstream media, the Canada's Food Guide was released this week, and plant-based proponents such as us are thrilled to see so many progressive changes in this year's guide, which has seen the elimination of meat and dairy categories and encourages Canadians to eat more plants and less meat. For our first interview today, we'll be speaking with leading vegan registered dietitian Vicenta Molina. She will give us her expert opinion on the guide's overhauled update that takes a plant-strong approach and what this could now mean for the future of the health of Canadians. And for our feature interview, we are excited to have former vegan radio host JL Fields here with us. JL is a vegan food educator who teaches cooking classes out of her base in Colorado Springs. She is also the author of 5 vegan-themed books, including her latest book, just released last month, called Vegan Meal Prep, Ready-to-Go Meals and Snacks for Healthy Plant-Based Eating. In today's interview with JL, we are going to indulge into the topic of learning some best practices when it comes to preparing your food for the week in advance with ease and success. That interview is coming up in about 27 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
Food, glorious food, how I hate to prepare you, except when I'm in the mood, the times which are very few. So that's my little poem for today. I looked at into my cupboards and my pantry in preparation for this today, and I looked at what I had. I have in bulk, I have lots of beans and lentils, nuts, oats, rice, seeds, and of course popcorn, and I have them all in jars. I bring them home, and they're usually in some kind of plastic unless I buy in bulk, which is a little difficult sometimes because we have peanut allergies in the house, so I have to be careful.
Okay.
But I always put them into glass jars right away to prevent the leaching of the hormone disruptors from the plastic. So I think that's kind of important to do. And then I have in my freezer, I have soups and stews and things. I like to make a lot of those because, as I've said, I don't like to prepare food, so I kind of like it to be ready. And I sometimes make up spice mixtures for my favorite recipes so I can just grab, whatever the amount is out of the jar instead of mixing them all together.
Thanks for sharing your thoughts with us, Carol, about, you know, food is not always something that you enjoy making, but it's something that we have to do. And if we want to make great food, we kind of need a process for it and we need to be organized. And that's going to be the basis of our feature interview today with JL Fields. Now, I like that you said that you put all your food into glass jars, because I do that too. And I wasn't even thinking about the plastic.
The hormone disruptors.
Yeah, yeah. I wasn't thinking of that. Yeah. So, and you like to make soups and stews too, huh? So,
well, it means like I make one meal and I can have it 3 times, or I can have it once and then freeze it and have it ready to go on in a few hours notice sort of thing.
And I understand you're into making preserves as well. Can you tell us about that?
Well, I actually do a lot of it with my daughter, and we've made pickles, and we've made pickled beets and cucumbers, and we've made things like salsa is a big one.
Yeah.
And we tried
soups and stews as well, black bean mm-hmm. soup and things like that. It doesn't can well, even though I've got a pressure canner, so it's a difficult thing. So usually we just freeze that.
You can just
stuff.
Put that stuff in the freezer yeah. and then pull it out when you need. Yeah. Yeah, I find it a challenge myself to make food in advance, and that's why I've been really enjoying JL's new book, Vegan Meal Prep, which mm-hmm. we've got here. I was showing it to you earlier, and it's great for busy people who don't have a lot of time, who might seem overwhelmed at what can I make and what ingredients will I need.
Right.
This book actually has a full ingredients list for every set of preps that it uses, which I really enjoy, because actually a lot of the ingredients, if you are a cook, if you cook in your home, you'll probably already have a lot of these staples already.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to think about it.
Yeah. And
so,
you know,
the list is already there.
Right. And as you was seeing yourself, like the list of ingredients, like they're all pretty normal ingredients, right?
Right.
So sometimes, well, I just posted a video last night of this very obscure vegan egg that you can make. Inside, you get an avocado right. half, and you scoop it out, and you use that as your shell, and then you mix some soft tofu with kala namak, which is Indian black salt.
Oh, it's right.
Eggy
yep.
smell.
Yep.
And
sulfury.
Yeah,
yeah.
Sulfury. And so first, but you make the white part, and it's the soft tofu and agar agar,
which is a Jell-O vegan thickener.
And you make that, and you fill up the half slice of the avocado.
With that.
It hardens.
Yeah.
And then you cut out a little hole, and then you make some other stuff. And I think you make it yellow with turmeric. And then you make, and with the eggy kala namak. And then you put that inside. And
right.
then I think you set it in the fridge or something, and it comes out. So I guess the purpose of today's show is that, yeah, you don't need to make stuff like that to be successful in a vegan kitchen, for sure. And we're going to be learning more about that today. I'm just excited about that. And even though you don't like to cook, Carol, I hope you might be inspired by this interview that we have coming up soon.
It looks really good. And
yeah.
I'm glad that she has all the ingredients listed out, because mm-hmm. some recipes have so many ingredients, they're overwhelming.
And it does become overwhelming.
It does.
So the purpose of today's show, the theme of today's show, is making food that's nutritious and healthy and also really easy to make.
Did you know that Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, has over 90 different shows produced by over 350 community members? This wide range of programming produced by our diverse group of programmers ensures that we have a show you'll love. We have shows on feminism, spirituality, disability rights, politics, unions, and parenting. We play jazz, indie rock, reggae, blues, and folk. We broadcast in a dozen different languages and have more First Nations programs than any other radio station in Vancouver. Find your show on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. All different, all the time.
Some events for you tonight. Tonight, there is a Co-Extinction Film and Sea Shepherds are getting together for an evening about ocean conservation, orcas, salmon, and igniting your passion in the spirit of adventure. This event is being held at Brackendale Art Gallery in Squamish. The doors open at 6 p.m. and the event actually starts at 7 p.m. sharp, but they've got some little food items and whatnot to start with. So there's two speakers followed by a panel discussion, and in addition to a sneak peek footage of the Co-Extinction documentary series. Please register for the event in advance through Eventbrite, Oceans, and Orcas. And Sunday, January 27th, there's a Cube of Truth in Richmond hosted by Anonymous for the Voiceless on Sunday at 4:30 p.m. till about 7:30 p.m. And it's at the Richmond Brig House Station, number 3 Road at Richmond Center. This is a really powerful outreach showing how animals are treated in our factory farms and offering help to those interested in finding out more about compassionate living. Next Thursday, January 31st, is a celebration of plant-powered vegan living at the Kwantlen University Vegan Expo Compassion Con 2019. That's a mouthful. Featuring plant-based vendors, information lectures, cooking, and zero waste demonstrations, free product samples, and raffles are actually coming up. So you can come and discover how you can make a difference for non-human animals, the planet, and your health. The event is free, it will be indoors, so don't have to worry about the weather, and it's in the conference center, and it runs from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. Next Thursday, two Thursdays from now, February 7th, from 4 to 6 p.m., there's a weekly vigil for the animals hosted by Tri-Cities Animal Save. This is a new thing, and Tri-Cities is actually Animal Save is a Canadian chapter of the Worldwide Save Movement. So the Save Movement's goals are to raise awareness, to help people become vegan, and to build a grassroots animal justice movement. So meet in front of Body by Brandt, which is on the Barnett Highway in Coquitlam. They supply all the signs. So that should bring some interest to what's going on in
there's a chicken slaughterhouse by there too,
right? There's a chicken slaughterhouse about a block on the back road, but this is to meet on Barnett Highway so that they get the high traffic.
Yeah, and I just want to say too that anyone and everyone is welcome to this. If you've never done animal activism before, this is a great welcoming atmosphere and a good way to meet people and to sort of put your foot into it and to see what this movement is all about.
And it's very non-confrontational.
Yeah.
Yeah. And looking ahead, if you're thinking about a tattoo, looking ahead to Saturday, April 27th, Vegan Tattoo Fundraising Event is hosted by Peace and Ultra Instinct Tattoo Studio. Now, they're in Langley, and you can call them if you're interested in this. They have what they're doing is they're doing vegan themed tattoos, and they're asking for $125, and the donation goes to it's going to be shared between Goats on the Rock Farm Animal Sanctuary and Little Oink Bank Pig Sanctuary. So call the tattoo studio at 604-510-4848 to book your time.
Okay, if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at info@animalvoices.org, or you can post it on our Facebook page at Animal Voices Vancouver.
For our first interview today, we have award-winning Canadian registered vegan dietitian Vicento Molina on the show. She is the head author of the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics' current position on vegetarian diets, and she has co-authored many leading vegan nutrition books such as Becoming Raw, Becoming Vegan Comprehensive Edition, Becoming Vegan Express Edition, Cooking Vegan, and most recently, the Kick Diabetes Cookbook. The highly anticipated updated version of the Canada's Food Guide was just released this Tuesday, and this time around, it advises that Canadians eat more plants and less meat. The Canada's Food Guide has traditionally served Canadians as one of our top trusted resources of nutritional advice. Vicento is here with us today to give us her expert opinion on what the new food guide will mean for the future of the health of Canadians. Hello, Vicento, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hello, Allison. Thank you. Yes.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today to speak about the latest version of the Canada's Food Guide, which was just released this week by our federal government. You've been involved with consultations for Canada's Food Guide for many years over your career, so I'm interested to know some of the history of the Food Guide first in the format that it was traditionally presented in. Can you tell us more about that and the progressive changes that subsequent iterations have seen over the years?
Okay, well, we've had food guides in North America since about World War I, and they used to have 7 food groups, even once 12 food groups, and they had the oil group and the fat group and the sugar group, and they've just gone through all kinds of different evolutions. And then for many years, several decades, we had the 4 food groups, which the top half of the food guide was meat in one corner and dairy products in the other corner. And these were a lot industry-based food guides. And they reflected the times. I mean, there were times when there were food guides that were related to the Depression, people just trying to get enough to eat. And after World War I, War II, we had ideas about a chicken in every pot. We're just trying to recover from some shortages. And now, of course, everybody had so much animal products that they ended up getting chronic diseases and obesity. And so Health Canada's put in a food guide that's really quite revolutionary because it's science-based, not industry-based. And we had a national convention in Vancouver for Dietitians of Canada in June, and Health Canada at that event, it was the national convention, said that this would be the focus of the food guide. And, of course, there was a lot of upheaval and disapproval from the animal products industries, from the Dairy Foundation that were at that conference, and the meat marketing boards were concerned in the media. But, of course, we've had some big changes in terms of our perception of these products. They're not seen as deliverers of essential nutrients. They're seen as being very much linked to our health problems.
Right. Well, times are changing. This is exciting. Proponents of the plant-based vegan lifestyle have been excited about the new food guide put out this week. Can you tell us about how animal products are now represented in the new version of the guide in conjunction with plant-based foods?
Okay. Well, first of all, we used to always have a food group that started with the word meat, but now red meat, and that means beef, pork, lamb, is classified by the World Health Organization. This is not some fringe group or vegetarian group. It's the World Health Organization has a strong body of scientists that put this classification together. But these red meats are classified as probable carcinogens, and they only do that when they have a lot of evidence. And cured meats, and that means sausage, bacon, hot dog, spam, are classified by the World Health Organization as convincing carcinogens. So it no longer makes sense to Health Canada that we have a food group that's headed by the word meat. I mean, we do need protein, but to be having it in the form that's delivering convincing carcinogens or probable carcinogens, it just doesn't make sense anymore. And so meat is definitely included in the food guide now, but the representation on the Canada Food Guide image is just small amounts, typically as what was done in, say, Asia for a long time. They can be included. They're certainly not essential, and they're not the only way to get protein or iron or other nutrients like that. The other big change is that there's not a group headed by the word dairy or milk, and we used to always have the milk group or the dairy foods. And in recent guides, there have been, for example, 23 different dairy products, and one alternative that wasn't dairy, which was a way to get calcium and vitamin D, and that was fortified soy milk. Now, it turns out that we can get calcium from a lot of different foods, from leafy greens like kale, broccoli, napa cabbage, collard greens. We can get calcium from calcium-set tofu, which is a very good protein and iron deliverer, even better iron source than milk. Sesame tahini, almonds, figs, blackstrap molasses, oranges, and then all the fortified non-dairy beverages. These can all give us calcium. So it's good to be extending our range and not relying on milk. Now, milk is a provider of nutrients like calcium, but we have a multicultural society, and approximately 70% of the world's population has some degree of lactase insufficiency or lactose intolerance, meaning that they get gastric problems if they try to digest significant amounts of milk or milk products. And so things are just reflecting our multicultural society. And the other big problem is that cheese, which became very popular and people thought of as a calcium food, and a protein food, but actually 75% of the calories were from fat. We've had strong links in the science that this is related to obesity, you know, a growing problem among children even, who are eating pizza all loaded with cheese and that kind of thing. So we don't have a dairy group on this food guide. We don't have a milk group on this food guide. Now, there is an indication of, say, have including yogurt. So there's in the protein group, there is figured calcium, cow's milk, yogurt, but it could be soy yogurt. It's just an image. And so this is just evolving, and I think it is so strongly science-based that those of us who are dietitians and have been following the science are really pleased with this new guide. And also, we have a society that is has socialized medicine. Like, our medical system supports us through chronic disease, but we can't be affording to have all these high risks of cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, obesity. And we know that as we get more plant-based, like if people are completely plant-based, they cut their risk of cardiovascular disease by two-thirds, and the same with type 2 diabetes. We can lessen our risk of becoming overweight or obese. We can drop our cancer risk by 19% and gastrointestinal cancers by 50% if we go more plant-based. So Canadians cannot just not afford to be having all these people getting sick with these chronic diseases. Plus, we don't want to get cancer, heart disease, type 2 diabetes. So it's really a very positive step, although it will take people a little bit to get used to it.
Wow, that's just all great information. It's so motivating and inspiring for what can come. I've also seen that the new guide, it goes beyond giving just simple nutritional advice, but adds information on healthy eating habits, such as being aware that food producers may attempt to influence consumer habits through marketing campaigns. And I think this is a first for our government to publicly recognize this reality. What is your take on this angle of education, given that animal agriculture has traditionally been a long-promoted industry by our government?
Oh, it sure has. They've been really key influencers for the food guide for a long time. But we're finding, for example, that feedlots in Alberta, one of Canada's largest feedlots, is winding down operations in Alberta, in Strathmore, High River, Mosley. So the Alberta beef producers are finding that they just can't keep producing beef. People aren't buying it as much. It's too expensive to produce. Now, I hope that we will also stop subsidizing these and perhaps start subsidizing organic plant foods, which have an entirely healthful foundation. So things are really changing.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting, too, that with the debut and real success of the Beyond Burger at A&W in Canada this past year, that our government is now putting funds into creating pea protein so that A&W can get these burgers made for people. They're vegan burgers. Isn't that incredible?
That's right. When that Beyond Burger came out that week, I did 11 interviews on the CBC.
Nice.
And we're a huge producer of lentils, of grains. You look at our prairies, and these do not need to be filtered through animals, which is just a way to shrink. Like, you get 1/16 the protein when you put kidney beans, for example, compared to protein production. And so we can just be using these our Canadian agriculture products, the grains, the legumes or pulses, and have wonderful food, wonderful health, and it's a big environmental plus. So I appreciate the Canadian government and Health Canada supporting this food guide also on an environmental standpoint, because we're really linking beef with more greenhouse gases and a lot of increased use of pesticides, herbicides, because they have to produce all these crops that are fed into animals, and there's the protein shrinkage idea. It contaminates the water. Like the problems that you find with lettuce, say, you know, when that had to be recalled in North America, well, that's from feedlots having these manure lagoons beside them, the pigs, the cattle, and that gets into plant crops. So we sort of blame romaine lettuce, but the actual origin was from animal intestines and the poop that goes on, and then it spreads into nearby plant crops. So anyway, this is just such a win-win-win-win-win. It's very exciting.
Well, thank you, Vicente Molina, for joining us on the show today to speak about the new Canada's Food Guide just released this week. To see the new guide yourself, you can go to food-guide.canada.ca, or there's a link on our website at animalvoices.org. And to learn more about Vicente's work as a vegan registered dietitian, you can visit her at nutraspeak.com. Thank you, Vicente. Have a good day.
Thanks, Allison.
You are listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. So I was doing a little bit of research and I came across something on octopus farming. Commercial octopus farming is currently in developmental stages on multiple continents. So this is being done in Spain, Mexico, Japan, and China. And the study team, which is a group of researchers out of New York University, believe that this would have a really negative ripple effect on sustainability and animal welfare, and concludes that this should not be done. The recent study states that mass-producing octopus would repeat many of the same mistakes that we make on land in terms of high environmental and animal welfare impacts, and be in some ways worse because we have to feed octopus other animals. Their examination of related existing studies revealed that the majority of farmed aquatic animals are carnivorous, for example, salmon and carp. Feeding these animals puts additional pressure on wild fish and invertebrates for fish meal. Around 30% of the global fish catch is turned into feed for other animals. So we're feeding fish to fish.
I think a lot of people don't necessarily recognize that.
I think you're right. And the main consumer really there is aquaculture. So there's the driving force behind overfishing is directly resultant of that 30%. Farming octopus is also, which is also a carnivore, would only exacerbate the current conditions. They also found that octopus farming would produce high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus pollution, which contributes to oxygen depletion in the ocean. And octopus have been proven to have considerable cognitive and behavioral complexity. So making farming, that would make farm acutely incompatible with their makeup, with the type of animal that they are. Because of this, there would be high mortality rates, increased aggression, and parasitic infection, which is also found in existing aquatic farms. So they feel it's going to be more pronounced with octopus.
Well, thank you for sharing that really obscure news story with us. You know, octopuses aren't something that's usually on the mind, but they are animals too, and we care about them. And I agree, they're so intelligent from the little that I actually did an interview once about octopuses. We can look that up online. It's on animalvoices.org somewhere.
I like them.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing the news. So for today's feature interview, we have vegan educator JL Fields on the show. JL is the founder and culinary director of the Colorado Springs Vegan Cooking Academy. She is a master vegan lifestyle coach and educator, food for life instructor, personal chef, career coach, and a corporate consultant offering wellness training and more. JL is the author and co-author of 5 vegan food books, including Vegan for Her, Vegan Pressure Cooking, The Main Street Vegan Academy Cookbook, The Vegan Air Fryer, and now Vegan Meal Prep, ready-to-go meals and snacks for healthy plant-based eating, which was
was just released last month in time for Veganuary. On today's show, JL is here to speak to us about tips and advice on vegan meal prep as written about in her new book, and we'll be gaining a lot of insights on how to make compassionate cooking easy and accessible to do. Hello, JL, and welcome to Animal Voices.
Oh, it's so great to be with you, finally.
Yes, finally. I wanted to have you on the show for a long time, and one of the reasons is because you have a great radio voice. So, you know, over the years, I've been watching you as well online as you've been spreading your vegan wings by becoming a dynamic vegan lifestyle advocate by teaching so many cooking classes, writing books, hosting your radio show, Easy Vegan with JL Fields, and much more. You haven't been vegan for that long either, considering the amount of work you've accomplished in the last several years. I am wondering if you could first share for our listeners a story of your vegan journey and how you came to embrace a lifestyle of compassion towards all living beings.
Sure. I think what I love talking to other vegans is, I mean, everybody has a really unique story and they do a lot of unique things as a result of that. And for me, you know, I used to run an international foundation to end violence against women and girls. And I was in Africa, I was in Kenya for an opening of a safe house. And at the point, just to, you know, for context, at this point, I'm in my late 30s and I'm meat eaten, actually smoked a pack a day back then.
Wow.
Young smoker, I ate meat. And I had, you know, being vegetarian or vegan was nowhere near my radar at all. But I was there, and during this really beautiful ceremony in which we opened the safe house for girls who are fleeing female genital mutilation, there were community members there, and a male elder walked in with his most prized possession, which was a goat. And subsequently, the goat was slaughtered and then stewed and served for dinner that night. And after dinner, I became a vegetarian. So I knew where meat came from. I'm from the Midwest in the United States. I get it, but there was just something about, you know, just kind of looking at this creature in the eye and then it becoming a meal. And, you know, I didn't become vegan right away, though. That was, you know, that was in my late 30s, and I was happily living vegetarian for 8 years while my husband continued to do all the cooking. He did the cooking at the time, and he did not go vegetarian, but cooked for me. And it was 8 years into being vegetarian that I had just kind of randomly, back in the day when I used to go on diets, kind of randomly did this cleanse of no alcohol, no sugar, no wheat, no dairy, everything I loved, nothing of that for 16 days. And I was just kind of like, oh, I didn't eat any animal products for 2 weeks. I'm just going to go ahead and be vegan. And that was when my husband was like, you know, I think you're on your own because I have no idea what to feed you. And so I was then 45 years old, had not been cooking for years, and was a new vegan. And I think that's kind of what started this whole trajectory. But since then, that was 9 years ago.
Amazing. So it has been longer because I've been following you for over the years and now they've crept up on us. So I love your new book, Vegan Meal Prep. It's unique from every other cookbook I've seen and it's so fun and accessible to read. You've had a lot of experience in teaching the vegan lifestyle to many people over these years. And I'm wondering if it was from this experience that you're compelled to write this book. Did you see a need for having a straightforward method and approach to batch cooking meals for people who are busy and in need of an easy and clear plan that they can follow to make tasty and nourishing meals for the week?
Yeah, you know, I think it was just sort of a logical next step. This is my fifth book. I co-authored two books, and then I had two cookbooks that I wrote on my own, the Vegan Pressure Cooking and the Vegan Air Fryer. And I've been teaching classes as part of sort of touring with those cookbooks, but then also realized that that was what I was really good at. And by being good at that, I want to be really clear. I don't think I'm a great cook. I don't think I'm a phenomenal chef. I don't teach knife skills. I don't teach people how to make a really fancy meal for their friends on a Saturday night. What I want is people to eat vegan. And I want it to feel accessible, to feel simple. I'm not going to say easy because I think that sometimes we forget about food deserts and culture and things that could make it be more complicated. I think that as vegans, we need to be careful about calling things easy when we're not in somebody else's shoes. But I think we can make the process once you're in it simpler and less complicated when it comes to ingredients and styles and all those things. And so that's what I realized I was pretty good at when I was in front of people, was just to say, you know what, let's make something in less than 10 minutes with 5 ingredients. I promise you it will be good. And I think you'll be able to do it at home. And so I'm saying that simply to say that's kind of that now where we are with vegan meal prep. It's that over these years, I started batch cooking just because I was into pressure cooking. And it's like, well, why not just make a bunch of beans right now? And they save money and I can just eat them all week. But it kind of got a little boring. And then the sort of art and craft of meal prepping has really crept up over the last several years, which is sort of like, I kind of joke and say it's batch cooking, you know, sort of on steroids, because it's taking those things and instead of just eating from the same bowl of brown rice and the same bowl of black beans for a couple of days and getting bored and then just chucking it all because you're sick of it, it's taking it and then portioning it out into beautiful and easily accessible to reheat or eat cold meals that look good from the container. And I think that's just been kind of the logical step to get there. Still really simple. I don't want it to be hard. I want people to feel like they can do it.
Well, you're making me hungry talking about it. Our co-host Carol has a question for you.
Yeah, so I've just looked at your book briefly. I haven't read it yet, but I've seen that it's divided into sections outlining 8 meal preps, and it consists of 70 recipes. Can you tell us about the process that you've provided for the meal preps? For instance, like you've got full list of ingredients and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so as I was just mentioning, meal prepping has sort of become this art, right? Or this sort of craft. People have YouTube channels devoted to it.
Right.
And it can feel complicated to people because they look at that. I always joke and say, you sit down and watch a meal prep YouTube channel and you feel super aspirational. You're like, yes, that's what I'm going to do. But yet it still feels a little overwhelming because I think that sometimes you're just like, but where do I start? How do I start? And so I worked with a really great publisher on this book. And with their, you know, guidance and their suggestions, we're like, let's make this easy for everybody. So some people are just going to want to dive in and go to the recipes. People who know how to meal prep or maybe aren't interested in meal prep but are interested in fast and easy recipes. But other people are like, what are you talking about? What is meal prep? So what I did was just took several of the recipes, of the 70 recipes, and turned them into different sort of themes. But those themes were used as a way to illustrate how one could meal prep. But I also wanted it to illustrate how diverse vegan food can be and vegan meals can be. But the point of the prep is that when you sit down and you're like, okay, I'm going to do prep number 4, which is called For the Love of Legumes. Now, as a coach, I'm trying to get people to fall in love with legumes and beans, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I also want them to have something right in front of them that talks them through it. So I let the reader know what the recipes are going to be. And in this case, it's 4 recipes. And then there's a shopping list of the ingredients that you're going to need, mm-hmm. and the equipment you're going to need. So you know, okay, this week I need a baking sheet, I need a cutting board, I need a food processor. So it sort of helps you plan ahead.
Right.
But what you'll also start to learn as you're doing this is a lot of these shopping list ingredients are already in your pantry, and it just kind of makes it easier. And then really the crux of this is to say, okay, we have 4 recipes. I want you to start with this recipe and go through step 2. Now jump in to the other recipe and do the first 2 steps. Now go back to this one so that instead of taking 4 hours to do 4 recipes, you're going to spend maybe an hour to 90 minutes completing them from start to finish because you're using your time well. And that's coaching you through the prep.
I love it. This is a great book for people who are new to the vegan lifestyle as well, but I am also finding it really useful as well as a seasoned cook. It's great. It's a great way to explore other ways of cooking that maybe you haven't tried before. In the book, you say that to cook vegan, you only need to focus on the 5 plant-based food groups, which are vegetables, fruits, beans, and legumes, grains, and nuts and seeds. Can you tell us more about how our listeners can visualize these food groups to create a full meal? And what are some examples of flavor profiles that you would like to recommend?
Sure. So I always start with that. And I learned that from Jenny Messina when she and I I think we all maybe organically know it mm-hmm. as we start to eat vegan. But when we wrote Vegan for Her, we did a plant plate that really showed these 5 food groups. Because some people will think, oh my gosh, vegan food, that sounds so complicated. When in fact, it's the least complicated, right? It's what the 5 groups that you just outlined. But if you're new to veganism, or eating plant-based. What you're really trying to do is re-envision that piece of meat or the dairy or cheese that had been on your plate. And so when I ask people to think about these five food groups is to think that at some point during the day, I want you to eat all five of these things, and some of them, a whole bunch of them. Vegetables and fruits, you're going to get so full on, and they're so good for you. And these beans and legumes can take the place of the traditional, I'm saying in quotes, protein, but what we're really talking about is entree on your plate. And so, you know, that could be an edamame hummus. That could be white beans that you mashed into potatoes and kale. But that's a really creative way to bring in a bean or a legume. And then grains, you know, sort of, you know, we know we can eat brown rice, but we've got quinoa, which is, you know, a seed actually, but, or farro or barley. And so this book was designed to break down and demystify all five of these things. And so a way to add a nut or seed could actually be to make a cashew sort of cream to pour over a mashed potato, which is a starch, and kale and bean mash. That's one of my recipes. So all three of them are together. You've got a potato, you've got kale, you've got beans, and then you've got a cashew sauce. So there you go. And then have a piece of fruit afterwards, and congratulations. All five food groups were done in no time.
Well, I can't wait to make some of your meal preps. I have all the ingredients for your first meal prep. I'm going to make them tomorrow. And speaking of flavor profiles, you speak about umami in your book and how we can draw the umami flavors out of food. So can you explain for our listeners what umami is?
Yes, I'm obsessed with umami, and everyone who takes my classes always laughs because I say, guess what I'm going to say? And they say, umami. So umami is a culinary term. We think in terms of flavors, flavor profiles or tastes as sweet, sour, bitter, and I always forget another one when I'm talking, salty. And in Japanese culinary cuisine, they say that there is a fifth flavor, and that is called umami, which translated can mean meatiness or savory. So over the years, many people have assumed, you know, particularly westernized countries have assumed that that literally means meat, when in fact, it's about essence that can come out of a food or ingredient. And so cooking methods that can bring out umami are grilling or braising or caramelizing. So it brings out this sort of meaty sense of satiety when you take a bite of food. But there are ingredients that also bring out the umami essence in your food, and those can be mushrooms, dried or fresh, very ripe tomatoes. And so that could be a canned jar of marinara sauce. It could be a grilled slice of tomato, nutritional yeast, soy sauce, fermented foods, pickles, beets, nutritional yeast. So as I'm describing these ingredients, what I'm hoping is that people visualizing them and thinking about those flavors are like, got it. Yeah, I can already sense that on my tongue when I'm sort of tasting that meaty ingredient. And the example I always like to give, which is very basic, is my husband is now vegan. He's been vegan for several years now, but he always can go straight for the sort of entree or the starch or the grain, and he doesn't focus on the vegetables as much, and he didn't really focus on salads so much. And one day I took a head of romaine lettuce and I sliced it in half, and on the had the flat sides up, and I drizzled fresh lemon juice over it, a little olive oil, pressed minced garlic in it, salt and pepper, and took it out onto the grill and grilled it face down, flat side down for a minute, flipped it over for 30 seconds. It had beautiful char marks. And then I brought it in, sliced it up, threw it in a bowl, and he devoured it because it was a warm, meaty salad, because that smell coming off the grill just kind of brought that umami out.
That sounds so delicious.
Umami. I'm salivating now. I love the word, too. It's fun to say.
I have it tattooed on my arm. I love it so much.
Nice. So speaking of taste, what are some of your favorite recipes in the book?
Well, you know, it's funny. Every time a new book comes out, I tend to go out and do a lot of cooking demonstrations and classes. And I like to make the ones that I think are going to be the ones that people will enjoy, but it's because it's the ones that we enjoy. The ones I've been making over and over again, this book has only been out for 6 weeks, the Spanish rice and the peppered pinto beans. Mm. I just taught a cooking class last night. It's so simple. And I should mention, especially, you know, Canada, the home of the Instant Pot, That because I wrote a book, Vegan Pressure Cooking, many of my recipes, when appropriate, I will give Instant Pot and pressure cooking instructions. So the Spanish rice recipe, you don't need a pressure cooker or an Instant Pot. I'm giving you the instructions to cook directly in a pot on your stove. But I also give the shortcut if you'd like to do it in about 22 minutes instead. But the Spanish rice is just simply brown rice and a hearty vegetable broth and a little tomato sauce and a and an entire tomato and some onion and lots of spices. That's it. And the peppered pinto beans is literally canned pinto beans, one red pepper, a jalapeno, and then some spices like cumin and a chipotle pepper. That's it. But those flavors combined in one bowl. And they watched me last night. I made the peppered pinto beans in 5 minutes in front of them, and they took a bite, and they were like, oh, my gosh, there's so much flavor. And that's why I focus so much about flavor in this book. So that's two of my favorites, but I got to tell you, the not tuna salad, and listen, I'm not some genius. We've been doing not tuna salads forever in the vegan world. It's chickpeas and something else. Mm-hmm. I have like five ingredients in it, and everyone goes nuts for it. And I will say that the secret ingredient for mine, in addition to the chickpeas, is heart of palm, which I think just gives it a great texture, and I think brings out some of that sort of acidic umami approach. And then for something snacky and really, really simple, or it's my banana nut bars. It's literally ripe bananas, rolled oats, a little maple syrup, a little vanilla extract, press it into a pan, bake it in 20 minutes, and you have a snack or dessert or even breakfast because it's nice and wholesome.
I can definitely make that one this weekend too, because everyone, you know, I always have ripe bananas. So what I've noticed about this book is that I already have most of the ingredients for each of the food preps, and all the other items are ingredients that are mostly produce items that are usually easily attainable to buy. I'm wondering if you can talk about your standard go-to ingredients that you recommend keeping in the pantry and fridge so that you can easily whip up meals.
Absolutely. And thank you for taking note of that. Whenever I created a recipe for this book, I would go into my pantry first because I thought if it's in my pantry, then it's probably going to be something that's accessible. So I'm glad that that was something that you noted too. Mm-hmm. So it should be no surprise that what I'm going to suggest as go-tos are going to really focus on umami, right? And so what I like to tell people in my cooking classes is to start to build a pantry that has the items that are going to be helpful to you in creating your meals and also add that flavor and umami. So I like to have a variety of vegetable broth bouillon powders. And so I do beef style, so it's vegan, chicken style. I have turmeric. I have curry powder. So whenever you see a recipe that calls for veggie broth, switch up the flavor profile and say, okay, you know what? I'm actually going to use a curry vegetable broth today, and I'm going to go Indian style with this rice instead of doing sort of maybe a Spanish style. And so a variety of veggie broths. I love having miso paste in the refrigerator. Miso paste, if it's new to people, is a soybean paste. It adds so much umami, but it adds flavor and protein and texture. And if it's new to you and you go to the store and you look at the price and you're like, gosh, that seems a little high, I'm here to tell you it can last in your refrigerator for over a year if you don't use a lot of it. So, because it's a fermented food. And then vinegars and spices. I think if you build your pantry with a variety of vinegars like balsamic and rice vinegar and apple cider vinegar and make your own. I will take dried fruit. Over the holidays, I took cranberries and cherries, both dried, put them in a jar, and poured just a plain generic balsamic vinegar over it, and I had a cranberry cherry-infused balsamic vinegar for my holiday dishes. And so there are really simple ways to take very simple ingredients and combine them for a real flavor pow.
Excellent. Well, with doing these meal preps, as in your book, they require dividing up the meals, and you're putting them in storage containers in your fridge or freezer so that you can then easily pull them out to use during the week. Now, I know you are a big fan of glass jars as a means of storage. We were talking about glass jars earlier in the show today. Can you tell us about why you like glass and what other storage methods do you recommend?
Yeah, and it's totally pragmatic. Like, it's not like I'm anti-plastic. I mean, although we can have a whole plastic topic, trust me, I understand that, and the implications on the environment, on animals. But it's really about, for me, it's practical. I take a lot of foods that have liquid in them. So when I'm going to the office, I might have leftover chili or a meal-prepped chili or a soup or a stew or a mason jar salad that has dressing in it. So a mason jar, when you screw that lid on, or even an old jar that you saved, an old jar of pickles, when you put that lid on, it's airtight. You could throw that in your backpack or your purse and it's not going to leak. So from a practical perspective, I like that. I also like it because when it's in the refrigerator, I can see what I made versus, you know, I have my flat BPA-free plastic containers that I have to remember what I put in those, right? But the glass ones I can kind of see. And then the glass ones, you can easily take the lid off and just put it in the microwave really quick if you use microwave, and it's heated up in no time. Of course, you can do that with the other containers. I will say the mason jar salad or the mason jars, I don't tend to use if I'm going to freeze a prep. And so I should mention, I don't think we actually said this, so maybe just so the listeners know. So this whole meal prep idea isn't just that you batch cooked, but when you're done, you will have each of the recipes will be individual containers. So if you made a recipe for four, you will have four entire meals in some kind of container. And some just make sense in a mason jar, and others, if you want to freeze them, might be better off in a plastic bag that you could reuse, or a rectangular glass container that has an airtight lid. And in the book, I always say how long something can store in a refrigerator and what is will do well in a freezer.
Love it. I love the idea of just having all this food ready to go because I have a really crazy hectic life. I just want to be able to pull out a meal from my fridge and put it in my bag to go to work and not worry about getting tomato sauce on my laptop, as you mentioned in the book.
Exactly.
Yeah. So one,
if I can, I want to say one thing. Yeah. I hear this from, not to be, you know, gender specific, but I hear it from women a lot, which is to say that their male partners, I don't know why, but their male partners don't want to eat leftovers. There's something about leftovers that scrunch up their nose. But when they do it as a prep, it doesn't look like a leftover. And so now they're taking them to lunch.
Fair
and my
enough.
Husband takes it to work now. So I just think that's interesting.
Fair enough. Well, one last question. We've just got a couple of minutes here. The updated Canada Food Guide just came out this week, and it has eliminated the meat and dairy categories and encourages Canadians to eat more plants and less meat. What do you see or hope for the future of veganism, where our governments are finally starting to get on board to promote plant-based eating and to reject help from the animal agriculture industry to influence the outcome of the guide?
Well, first off, you guys must be over the moon in Canada about this.
Yeah.
I think it's the best
news. Big news
ever.
This week.
it's huge news, and we're talking about it here. And I'll tell you, when I first looked at that, I was like, oh, Canada, I love you so much for so many reasons these days. I've always loved Canada, but you guys just like have it together with things like this. And so there was this part of me that was like, I wish we were like Canada. But then I thought, well, but wait a second. There was a time when we felt a vegan world was unsurmountable. And things have changed so dramatically in a very short period of time. More people are being motivated to eat plant-based for all kinds of reasons and to choose veganism. And if we can see that much change over the last few years about what happens at a store or a restaurant or young people coming out of college and choosing vegan, then why can't we think that our activism could do the same thing? So instead of being jealous of Canada and thinking that the U.S. will never do it, it just motivates me more as a food activist to figure out a way to have an influence here as well.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, JL, for coming on the show to tell us about your new book, Vegan Meal Prep, Ready-to-Go Meals and Snacks for Healthy Plant-Based Eating. To find out more about this book and all of JL's other books and her work in vegan outreach, you can visit her website at jlgoesvegan.com. Also, by that name at Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and Instagram. I also highly recommend getting the book for yourself, and the Kindle version is now available on Amazon.com for free. Thank you, JL. Thank you all so much for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us for our show next Friday, February 1st at noon, when we'll have Josie Detoit of the Vervet Forest Project, and we'll be interviewing her from South Africa. We want to connect with you online, so check out animalvoices.org, where you can stream or download the show and find other goodies and links and different writings. Our podcast is available through iTunes and Google Play now, and stay in touch through our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
To end the show, we will be playing a song in the memory of a person who was very special in my life, in my childhood, Ben Stewart. I was so sorry to learn that he passed away last week. He was only 42 and also a former radio host himself. Life is short. Please take the time to nourish your relationships now before it's too late.
Here is Madonna's I'll Remember, dedicated to the late Ben Stewart, who will be missed dearly by many. Rest in peace, Ben. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Say goodbye to not knowing when the truth in my whole life began. Say goodbye to not knowing how to cry. You taught me that, and I'll remember the strength that you gave me. Now that I'll remember.